we reflect on going out to the desert and being confronted with the temptations that are there in us that we'll need to say no to in order to be able to fully say yes to the new kingdom life that's found in God. I wish you a blessing in these last several days. And we begin with this question. The disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" And I think this question can be a lifelong one with different nuances and different insights that you come to along the journey. For this particular season, we're looking at 13 different biases that that are pretty normal for being human on this planet. And when I kind of reflect on these biases, it gives me maybe one angle of insight of why Jesus might speak in parables. I can envision Jesus saying, "Why do I speak in parables? Well, because one, we all have a confirmation bias, which the human brain welcomes information that confirms what it already thinks and resists information that disturbs what it already believes. So you think of the kingdom that Jesus is bringing is really upending a lot of confirmation on what people believe that kingdom is going to do and be about. Why do I speak in parables? Because the human brain prefers a simple lie to a complex truth. We have a bias for keeping it simple. That's the complexity bias. Or the comfort bias. We welcome data that lets us relax, and we resist data that says, repent, change everything you know about reality, and believe the good news of the kingdom. Why do I speak in parables? Because we have a community bias. It's hard to see anything that will jeopardize our belonging to our group that we love. It's hard to see what our group doesn't see. We see as our group sees. Why do I speak in parables? Because of the contact bias. If you lack contact with a person or group, you will be unable to see what they see. So that was the first 2 weeks, and last week we looked at these three, the consciousness bias. We can only see from our location and level of maturity, growth, and consciousness. Complementarity bias. If people like us, we are open to what they say. If we perceive them as hostile, we'll be closed to them, we'll be biased against them, so we're naturally have a bias to accept what who we consider friends. Yeah. And competency bias. We tend to underestimate our level of incompetence and our level of competence. We can be confidently incompetent and unassured in our level of competence. So that's review. And this morning, we're going to look at three more. Why do you speak in parables? Well, kind of coming off of the competency, we are attracted to confidence. We prefer a confident lie to a hesitant truth. We're biased towards people that are confident. Next is a conspiracy bias. Shame makes us vulnerable to stories that cast us as the victims of an evil conspiracy. And conservative liberal bias. We see how our political party sees and flock with those who see as we see. So this is similar to the community bias. But then there's just a lot more research, especially in if you're Western and American in particularly, of how these political communities, conservative and liberal, shape the way we see. Okay, so that's what we're going to do this morning. Look at these three. Again, I invite you to take in a deep breath. Let it out slowly. I want you to pay attention to how you're feeling, what you're feeling in your body, what you're responding to, what you resonate with, what you resist, and kind of in all of those, take a moment just to observe those responses and interrogate them a little bit, or welcome them or observe them. Now, be curious this morning. And I want to begin kind of where we ended off last week. This was the competency bias and the Dunning-Kruger effect curve of their research of level of confidence on the left side of the graph, and then kind of running horizontally is your actual level of competence. We tend to underestimate our level of incompetence and our competence. We can be confidently incompetent and not assured in our competence. So I love this graph in kind of moving towards the confidence bias. We are attracted to confidence. We prefer a confident lie to a hesitant truth. And I like visualizing these together. Think of someone who is presenting what they know confidently, but are like on the peak of sophomoric, you know, the wise fool. So we actually can be led astray by someone who doesn't have a high level of competence, but is just saying what they say with an assured certainty. We can be really attracted to that, or our brain tends to find that interesting, where we can sniff out hesitancy or unsuredness. They don't sound real confident. Kind of raises a red flag that maybe they don't really know what they're talking about. So, but you can see on this Dunning-Kruger effect that someone in the valley of despair and in kind of ascending the slope of enlightenment has a higher level of competence, yet they might not be presenting themselves very confidently. Yet they actually know more than the person who is just confident and unaware of their true level of incompetence. And just pause there for a second, and we'll see how these kind of link together. I'm going to see this with the conspiracy bias. Shame makes us vulnerable to stories that cast us as the victims of an evil conspiracy. So I'm going to pause on this slide and just ask a few questions to create some space. And I'm curious of how this strikes you. Where do you feel this? Where do you see this at work? Confidence. We prefer a confident lie to a hesitant truth. And shame makes us vulnerable to stories that cast us as the victims of an evil conspiracy. Here's one question to create some space. When have you felt shame? And have you ever noticed in that shame, were you attracted to maybe a story that set you up as the victim and the other person, you know, the victimizer, in a way that helped alleviate the pain, some of that pain. Like you could kind of put it over there on that other group. Might be one way that this works its way out. You know, I've been thinking of the trauma of this week with the shooting in Atlanta. And the story of this shooter that comes, you know, from a very conservative Southern Baptist evangelical, you know, kind of fundamentalist kind of congregation. You know, one element when I think of theologies of shame, especially in purity systems, or purity culture, in which there's all kinds of felt shame around your sexuality. And, you know, some of the most damaging theologies of sexual shame is, you know, men have uncontrollable sexual desires, and women are objectified as the Eve temptress that, you know, kind of causes men to fall. So those theologies, you know, with you experience sexual shame, and then there's like this blaming out. The problem is women. You have a lot even with white supremacist thinking, in which kind of Orientalism of the fetishizing of Asian bodies. So I don't know, when I could pause here in this slide, and in some ways what I'm feeling in my body is just a desire to weep. Just weep over this, of how much pain has been transmitted. Because we don't, because we don't know what to do with the shame that we feel. Have you experienced theologies of shame? Have you experienced cultural or institutional forces of shame, or family systems of shame? But when I learned about this piece, that it's shame that makes us vulnerable to conspiracies, I think of the vast number of kind of outrageous traction that conspiracy theories have garnered over the years and are present with us. And, you know, it can kind of make you want to knock your head against a wall, and maybe family members you love, that have been caught up in QAnon, or we can look at the confident big lie that the election was stolen, and then you can, if like when we get to conservative liberal, if like conservatives are demons and the liberals are demons, and you are carrying a lot of shame, my wondering is, does this help give some insight into what's going on in the world? A confident lie mixed in with a culture of shame makes whole communities vulnerable to conspiracy theories. Or I think of how the tribe I grew up in as evangelical considers itself one of the most persecuted groups in America. So kind of white evangelical Christian, the perceived identity is one of a victim. That's really curious to me. But when I consider that so much of that religious system is integrated with deep theologies of shame, you're born totally depraved and deserve an eternal conscious torment in hell because of that utterly untouchable uncleanness in the sight of a holy God, then it even lends itself that the gospel itself becomes a bit of a conspiracy theory, that but God chose a few people, which are you because you've accepted Jesus, and the rest of the world is basically evil and depraved. And if that's the lens, then these totally depraved people, maybe they do drink the blood of kids. And it's just a fascinating place. But when I kind of hold this slide up, it makes me just want to weep. What's stirring in you? I'll just pause here before we move on. Any thoughts this brings to mind, or questions or curiosities for you as you process what's going on in your own life, in your extended families, in our culture at large? What's stirring for you? And then I'll add this last one. Let's see, we prefer a confident lie to a hesitant truth. Shame makes us vulnerable to stories that cast us as the victims of an evil conspiracy. Conservative and liberal, we see how our political party sees and flock with those who see as we see. This I've done. There's kind of two different elements on this of research on the conservative liberal bias. This one we've done before in other series, which is Jonathan Haidt's work, Moral Foundations. And I want to list these six here just for those who might not have seen this before, and as a review for those who have. We usually process things morally in these six different dimensions: care and harm. So do no harm as a primary moral value. fairness and reciprocity versus cheating, in-group loyalty versus betrayal, authority and respect versus subversion, purity and sanctity versus degradation, liberty and freedom versus oppression. So when those are violated, you have a moral response to these. That's wrong. Why is it wrong? Well, because you're cheating. Why is that wrong? Well, because you committed treason. You betrayed the group. Why is that wrong? You disrespected authority. Why is that wrong? Jesus, you disrespected the Sabbath, the purity and the sanctity of the Sabbath. Oppressiveness over personal freedom, a sense of freedom that is being thwarted. You feel like that is wrong or just harming somebody. And I'll pause here. Weeping with you, David, I see this dynamic at work in my family. I'm so sorry. I appreciate the continuity between what we're talking about this morning and the McLaren book we've just read, Faith After Doubt. Yep, thanks, Jason. On the moral foundations, I'll share this website. So this is kind of where the conservative liberal spectrum kind of plays into these moral foundations. If you go to yourmorals.org, you can do an assessment. So I'm sharing mine. This was from several years ago. So my score is in green. Liberal Americans who self-identify that way are in blue, and self-identifying conservatives are in red. So the major takeaway is that if you self-identify as conservative, you feel and make moral judgments almost equally along the six foundations. Now, there's only five listed here. Liberty versus oppression is an additional one that's been added. So you see it kind of hovers around that 3.1. So a purity violation or a violation against authority or a betrayal in your group is kind of measured similarly to someone getting harmed and fairness. You have a strong sense of morality around all of those, right? If you self-identify in more traditionally American liberal categories, your sense on care and harm and fairness are higher than loyalty, authority, and purity. Okay? Those don't register as strong. So a sense of that's not fair or that brings harm is felt so much more significantly as moral. And you're less to think of, well, sometimes, respect of authority is the problem. Not all authority should be, we should subvert the authorities. Or your sense of loyalty to the group. It can be like, that can cause a lot of problems. And like, purity laws, really? And you know, these people are, so that's just kind of a general dispersion of how, when it comes to moral reasoning, traditional liberals and conservatives do that differently. And a lot of this is thought to be, you know, highly predisposed. Genetic almost, in how you're wired. And this is in some ways why, if you're kind of more wired conservatively, you can perceive yourself as more moral than a liberal person, because it seems like liberals are immoral when it comes to like loyalty, authority, and purity. So there can be a sense of moral superiority that can be a part of you as a conservative group, because it's like you're reasoning along six domains and liberals are only two. But that's true in a liberal bias. Like, I'm more moral because you don't understand how all of those things are working against care, fairness, and harm. So it's easy for your particular group to think of yourselves as morally superior. It just kind of shows up in different ways. So yourmorals.org, if you want to take that survey and kind of see where you line up. So Tara read from Luke 6, and you can see Jesus do some interesting things where he presses buttons. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?" Isn't that interesting? What Jesus does is take something out of the purity sanctity category. The Pharisees are offended because he's degrading the Sabbath. He's making the Sabbath feel like a Monday instead of a holy Saturday. But Jesus says, well, which is lawful? He brings it into, you know, if you want to sanctify the Sabbath, are you doing harm or promoting life? Is it lawful to care on the Sabbath for this man with the shriveled hand? To save life or destroy it? So Jesus kind of is taking the purity category and seeing how does our desire for holiness and sanctity work towards life, fairness, thriving. And if our holiness is actually life-destroying, it really is not holy. Here is a passage from Mark 7. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside of a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them." So again, the Pharisees are asking Jesus, why doesn't his disciples, why don't they wash their hands? You know, so this is about like a ritual of cleanliness. And so Jesus again takes this idea of purity, and then inverses. You don't become impure because you ate a certain food that was unclean or you didn't wash your hands. No, he affirms like this purity dimension, but it like is coming from a different place, from the inside. What comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come: sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. So he's flipping the religious system that was so focused on outward appearance. Who do you or don't you eat with? What do you or don't you eat? How and when do you wash your hands? You can, you know, again, I think of the tragedy in Atlanta of seeing that spa and those people are what are making me unclean. And if I can get rid of them, it will kind of keep me pure. But you see, it's like all of that violence and murder and sexual immorality was inside the shooter. It wasn't outside. So you see Jesus calling attention about how the religious system is doing moral reasoning and helping it go deeper. Donette says, wow, this visual is helpful. Thank you. I think that's the moral domains. I'm glad, Donette. Jesus is constantly trying to help his tribe evolve our story in light of a bigger story, which the tribe struggles to see. Parables help. That's a wise saying. Is that Tony? Thank you. The other research dimension, and it kind of uses, it's using parenting stereotypes here of kind of like a male patriarch and woman nurturer. So I apologize for the ways those are inaccurate. This is just kind of one of the ways the research continues to describe things on the conservative liberal bias. But there tends to be a worldview behind some of the ways people work out their interpretation of reality. So one is governance as a strict father tends to be associated with someone who self-identifies as conservative. And there's more of a sense that people are bad. Kind of like, are people generally good or bad? There's a sense that people are generally bad and lazy. Therefore, they need strict discipline, threats of punishment, and tough treatment to deter bad behavior and motivate good behavior. Vice versa, liberal consciousness tends to think more in terms of governance as a nurturing parent. And the idea is, no, people are generally good and long to thrive. They just need support, resources, and thriving environments. Give people a supportive, nurturing environment. Good things and human flourishing will result. No, if you don't have rules and strict discipline and kind of negative motivation, people won't work hard. People won't be motivated to get a better education or a better job. Maybe some of these stereotypes can be seen in our conversations around policing. So defunding the police, you know, if we use those resources to provide housing and good schools and just environments, we won't have crime. You know, so that's like a nurturing parent. Defund the police to someone who has a view of the world where, no, people left to themselves are going to break the law. That is really scary. No, you get rid of the police, it's anarchy. People are going to be stealing things, are going to be, you know, murdering each other, and it's going to like just be absolute chaos. So you can see how these perceptions and worldview then shape a lot of the conversations. I'll pause there and again take in a deep breath. What's stirring in you? What questions does this raise? What curiosities? How do you want to push back on this? So with the conservative liberal bias, you see differences on moral foundations, how you process those six different domains. And then maybe you see the world as like people are generally good or people are generally bad. And what do you need? Well, you need a strict parent or a nurturing one, given those assumptions. You know, I'll say just before we continue on, when you look at these moral foundations, purity and sanctity, you know, I'll just go on mine because I still have a pretty high, say purity foundation. But what I found is that impulse is like kind of shifted from externals to internals, and from like people's behavior more toward environment. So I'm more likely to feel that line three is a degradation of the environment, the sanctity of land and water. I can usually, you can tell if your purity foundation is being violated because you have a sense of moral disgust. So moral disgust is felt when there's a sanctity violation. So someone might have a sense of moral disgust around the American flag being degraded, where someone else might have a sense of moral disgust when land and trees are being degradation. That's even the words that we tend to use. So in some ways, a lot of the questions, there's researchers are and moral foundations are starting to reshape these because the questions tend to be not environmental. And so then I think that's in some ways why that tends to be so much lower in a liberal lens. So that's just some additional commentary. I just have a couple slides on our current reality that you all feel, but this kind of demonstrates maybe some of the research around what you feel is the growing divide between liberal and conservative. So these questions, kind of questions from 1994, self-identifying Democrats, and I don't necessarily really identify with a political party, and you may not either, but you can just sense those who identify kind of medium Democrat values and a medium Republican values, and even in 1994, they were pretty close to one another. You see in 2004 that almost they almost got a little closer, and then you see from that to 2017, and again, I don't know that this has been updated yet. This was the last data I had. You can see, you know, the growing gap in between those values. There's not a whole lot of overlap. It's as if, you know, kind of our community bias, our conservative liberal bias, our confidence bias, our competency bias, all of these biases, you know, are these forces, and different narratives are, you know, bringing a lot more daylight between kind of these two groups of people. And in that space is a growing level of contempt. And, you know, I think we deal with a lot of the pain of these divisions by transmitting that pain to the other group. And I wrestle with this because, you know, I'd be like, there's plenty of like wrong that's actually wrong that needs to be held accountable. But I do really want us to work on identifying when contempt takes root in us, because it's not a healthy emotion. Anger can be a healthy emotion. Contempt is hierarchical. So there's a ranking. When I feel contempt, I am superior and better than you. and you are less than. Contempt is a dehumanizing emotion. So that's why I think it's pretty important to pay attention when contempt takes root in our own hearts, and learning how to deal with the pain of what's going on and the injustice of what's going on in ways that can lead to actual thriving and change. I'll pause here. Interesting, the spread around the median has grown over the decades in this analysis, implying that what it means to be one of the other is changing. A lot more gray area. Yeah. I think there are those changes. This was a recent story that was just came out March 17th that kind of, I think, looked at this last election. A close-up picture of partisan segregation among 180 million voters. So I just have three cities, but it's an interesting article if you want to do a search for that. But you can see Minneapolis, Chicago, and Detroit. But kind of what was surprising to the researchers on this data, it's that even like when you zoom into like very particular neighborhoods, they tend to be segregated. And there's a lot of questions. There's not really why is that? And even as you like go out, so it's not just urban, rural, but even within different particular neighborhoods like that you can, you know, scroll in and find. And there's just a lot of curious questions going on. Do actual neighborhoods start to influence and change one another to start voting similarly? Do some of the like these community influences and biases actually start to reshape demographics? So it's kind of an interesting thing, but what these maps just kind of illustrate is the segregation of these of the groups, and that it's becoming more pronounced in time. I found it an interesting article. So in the Luke 6 passage that Tara read, it started with kind of confronting the Sabbath violation and asking the question, what's lawful, to kind of promote life or destroy it? You know, you ask that question. And then it immediately goes into Jesus choosing 12 apostles. And this has always been like a curious observation, but the way that Luke frames this, you get the sense that it is interesting that Jesus didn't choose any Pharisees, at least that we know of. That of the labels that are there, it's like the religious leaders that are constantly questioning Jesus, they're not picked. So it's not as if the diversity of the disciples needed to include everyone. They didn't. But there is the interesting, you know, polar difference between Simon the Zealot politically and Matthew the tax collector. I mean, they would have been on the far radical extremes about what was going on in Israel at the time. So a radical revolutionary who would support violent overthrow of the Roman Empire, and Matthew collecting taxes for the empire, makes for an interesting group dynamic. And so I wonder, you know, these the group who Simon hung out with and the group that Matthew hung out with, they'd be pretty biased against each other, of being open toward one another. And so I just wonder how Jesus and the kingdom can create a a new force that can kind of lift us up above and in a different way or a different direction. And I don't see this as Jesus is in the middle. I see Jesus as saying, metanoia, repent, change mind for a completely different reality than the one that's being proposed by your groups. If everyone just obeyed the Roman Empire and did what they were told, you will be fine. Obey the rules and it'll go okay. Simon, no, it's that obedience is oppression and we need to violently overthrow it. So Jesus, in a sense, taking these two that represent two very different groups and inviting them into a different way of seeing and being in the world. And I think that's the good news, or the gospel invitation. The kind of like create this new space beyond our particular tribal ways of being and seeing the world, and almost constantly challenging us to a different way of being human in the world. So I find that all very, very compelling. Okay. That's the information I wanted to share today. Pause again, and then I've got a poem that I want to read. Does anyone have any stirrings they want to share? This art is by Maria Laughlin, and it's Jesus healing the blind man named Bartimaeus. And in this season of Lent, where we're wanting Jesus to heal our eyes and our ears so that we can be people who learn how to see and learn how to hear, given all of the things that kind of might stand in the way or prevent us, how can we appreciate how our biases got us to where we are, and be able to appreciate that, and then be able to recognize the blind spots in them. Oh, I had missed this. Someone wrote, my fairness is up at 4.9. Awesome. It is kind of an interesting, I encourage you, yourmorals.org, to take that assessment and just see if you've got one that is particularly higher than the others. That is, you're going to be heightened in everything that really works against a sense of fairness. Or harm or oppression. So if you're wired more like libertarian, that oppression, that feeling of being oppressed is super high. And if you're triggered like on oppression more than, say, all of the others, which can be libertarian, you might be able to see why someone could get so offended about a mask mandate. Anything where an authority is telling you what to do feels like a profound moral violation that needs to be resisted. Just different people are triggered in different ways. And then if you like get a tribe of people that way, I know there was a group of parents suing our school district because of, you know, not having in-person school for high school. You know, just see how some of the energies behind these different moral foundations get worked out in public. All right. I'm going to read a poem now from Stephen Gurness Holmes on Blind Bartimaeus. And may these words wash over you and inspire you with a blessing. Dearly beloved, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting beside the way. What is the way you are beside? Something incomplete? Something not yet happening? Offer it to God. I'll read that question again. Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting beside the way. What is the way you are beside? Something that's incomplete. Something not yet happening. Offer that to God. Bartimaeus began to shout out and say, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Many sternly ordered him to be quiet. What has silenced you? What has kept you from rushing headlong to God? Bartimaeus began to shout out and say, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And many sternly ordered him to be quiet. What has silenced you? What has kept you from rushing headlong to God? Jesus stood still and said, call him here. Imagine Jesus calls you. Jesus wants you near. They called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, get up, he is calling you. Recite these words to yourself. Take heart, get up, your love is calling you. Take heart. Get up. Your love is calling you. Throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Your soul is not as timid as you. Casting your safety aside, leaping unseeing to the beloved. Throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Know that your soul is not as timid as you, casting your safety aside, leaping unseeing to the beloved. Then Jesus said to him, what do you want me to do for you? Let Jesus ask you. And again, let Jesus ask you, what do you want me to do for you? My teacher, let me see. My teacher, let me see. What would you see? Jesus said to him, go, your faith has made you well. You're crying out, your soul's leaping. Your blind begging is holy. Your blind begging is holy. Immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. What is the new way you will follow on? Immediately he regained his sight and followed Jesus on the way. What is the new way you will follow on? Pray this all day long without ceasing. Jesus, beloved of God, have mercy on me. Jesus, beloved of God, have mercy on me. Amen.